Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Spotlight, the movie based on the Boston Globe's award-winning 2002 expose of clergy sexual abuse, opens on Friday. The movie's being called an Oscar contender. Variety magazine even recently put out a cover picture of veteran journalist Walter Robinson, actor Michael Keaton, who plays him in the film, and director Tom McCarthy standing with purpose in the back of a newspaper delivery truck. So, yes, there is a huge amount of buzz about this film, but it's buzz about a Hollywood version of a true story that happened to real people about a courageous investigation into a massive institutional failure that wrought profound personal tragedy for thousands of real victims. So this week, we're going to take a look at what Spotlight the movie means for Boston. And joining us in the studio to help kick us off this examination is, Walter Robinson. He was then editor of the Spotlight team, and now he's editor at large for the Boston Globe. Walter Robinson, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you. Also with us is Michael Resendiz. He was then lead writer and reporter on the Spotlight series, and he's still with the Globe Spotlight team. Michael, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, pleasure to be here.
It's great to have both of you. Congratulations on the film, by the way. And I should tell listeners, if you got a question for us, send us a tweet at Radio Boston if you want to send a question for Walter or Mike Resendiz. But gentlemen, I just actually want to start by playing a clip from the film. This is courtesy of NPR's Fresh Air, because it really puts us back in the early 2000s, you know, in sort of the mindset and the mood of Boston and the community and what was really at stake with the Spotlight team's investigation. Because here from the movie, we've got a scene where the Spotlight series hasn't been published yet, but news of your investigation is starting to get filtered back to the church. And so in this scene, you, Walter, played by Michael Keaton, you're at a bar. It's funny. Should I say, like, the fictional Walter Robinson is at a bar having a drink with Pete Conley, who is advisor to Cardinal Law, and he's played by actor Paul Guilfoyle. And here's what Conley tells Robinson in the film.
You know, people need the church more than ever right now. You know, you can feel it. And the Cardinal, you know, the Cardinal, he might not be perfect. But we can't throw out all the good he's doing over a few bad apples.
Walter Robinson, hearing that in 2015, the few bad apples comment, I mean, it just still sends a chill down your spine. Did that conversation really happen the way it's played in the film?
No, that's a fictionalized scene, but it's intended to represent conversations that took place over time with a lot of people. Both before we published and after we published. And one thing that's pretty common is that people who were not directly involved with the archdiocese in these sexual abuse cases, they themselves, as high-ranking influential Catholics, had no idea what was going on behind the scenes.
So that's why, people genuinely thought it was a few bad apples, Mike.
Well, I think a lot of people did. I think a lot of people knew it was more than that. But, you know, we always say that we did not discover clergy sex abuse. Before we came along, there were clergy sex abuse scandals all over the country, Louisiana, Texas, other places. But still, the phrase you always heard from church officials, well, it's a few bad apples, and the number of abusers in the Catholic Church is no greater than it is in the larger society. I think we all know differently now.
Mm. Well, can you take us back to the beginning? Because I think a lot of people still don't really know how the story in reality got started for you guys at the Spotlight team.
Well, it started on July 30th of 2001. That was the first day we had a new editor at the Globe, Marty Baron. Marty came from the Miami Herald in a state, Florida, where everything is public. He came to the Globe. The day before he started, he read an Eileen McNamara column about the fact that Father Gagan was facing 84 lawsuits and his personnel files, which had been turned over to the plaintiff's attorney, were put under seal by the judge. And in her column, Eileen wrote, "The truth may never be known." Mm-hmm. And that is a red flag to Marty Baron. And in his first news meeting on Monday morning, he said, "Well, what about these records? Well, have we considered going to court to try and get the release?" And nobody had considered it. I mean, here's a pair of fresh eyes. And by that afternoon, he had called myself and Ben Bradley Jr. into his office and said, in addition to the court action, how about we have the Spotlight team take a look at this one priest, Father Gagin?
Yeah. Well, Mike, can I just ask you a question about that? Because it's so funny, because we're talking about a movie that based on events back in 2001, 2002, and here we are in 2015. But what does it mean that, in a way, I mean, it took Marty Baron, an outsider from Florida, to come in and encourage, you know, one institution, the Boston Globe, to question another institution, the Catholic Church? Because that's a big part of this story of, like, Boston institutions facing each other.
I think Marty's fresh eyes were a tremendous asset here. I mean, look, Boston is the most Catholic major city in America. Many of us at the Globe, myself and Walter included, were raised Catholic. So going up against the church, it's not something that occurs to you every single day. Mm-hmm. And Marty has said that when he made that suggestion in the newsroom, he was greeted by mostly silence. I think because of Boston's tribal nature, because of the role the Catholic Church played in the city for decades, it was a very unusual, even unheard of idea.
Okay, so the Spotlight team launches its investigation. I mean, at what point, I know you've been asked this question a million times, but it just still, at what point in time did you realize that it was something enormous?
Well, we had, I like to say, and I'm half kidding here, but we had a new boss, and you always act out of fear when a new boss asks you to do something. So our team had never done anything. You know, we'd done public corruption, bad builders, but we didn't have a single file about the Catholic Church. So we set out to find out as much as we could as quickly as possible about the Gagin case. And almost immediately, I would say within a week or two, we found out that there was a large number of priests involved, 12 to 15 or something like that. And we thought that would be a huge story, that Gagin was just the tip of a very large iceberg. So we went back to Marty, and Marty said, go for it.
But there was a particular moment for me that I'll never forget when I realized we were onto a very big story. After I had spent several weeks interviewing Gagin's victims, it was clear to me, it was clear to all of us that John Gagin had spent 30 years molesting children. Mm-hmm. I was at my desk and I looked up the church directory to see what John Gagin's last assignment, his final assignment after three decades of molesting more than 100 children. And I followed the dotted line next to his name to his assignment, and it was altar boys. And that's when I knew this had to be a big story. If church officials would allow that to happen, what wouldn't they allow?
Did the process of reporting this story, I mean, you mentioned that you were both Catholic. Did your own Catholicism bring it into question, your relationship with the church, with your faith?
Well, I think my faith is my faith, and more so now than then, less in the institution. But I think in the case of all of us, we understood the culture of the Catholic Church because we had grown up in it. And we were, frankly, horrified to find out the extent to which this abuse had gone on. I mean, if you went back 10 years and somebody came up to you as a journalist and said, oh, by the way, over 250 priests in the Boston Archdiocese have abused thousands of children, and it's all been covered up over the years, you would think somebody's telling you that would sort of need to be carried away. Mm-hmm. And that's precisely what was going on. I mean, that these crimes were so unimaginable that when a single priest here and there got caught and the church said this is one aberrant case, I think people tended to trust them on that.
Yeah. You know, we have the luxury of sort of moral clarity on this now after, you know, the fruits of your investigation have been with us for so long. But, you know, it wasn't smooth sailing as the Spotlight team was doing what you guys were doing in 2001, 2002. I mean, there had to have been some rough patches. Some of them are actually featured in the film in Spotlight. And so I want to play a clip here that actually dramatizes, and again, I'm going to ask you guys if this really happened, but an argument between you, Mike, and you, Walter Robinson. And it, the argument in the film is over when to publish the Spotlight series. Mike, you have the singular honor, I guess, of being played by Mark Ruffalo. And in the scene, it's depicted that that you feel like the story should be published after discovering that the head of the Archdiocese, Cardinal Law, knew about the abuse. And Michael Keaton, playing Walter Robinson, thinks that they should wait to publish. So again, NPR's Fresh Air, thank you for the audio of the scene from Spotlight. But let's listen.
Why are we hesitating? Barron told us to get law. This is law.
Barron told us to get the system. We need the full scope. That's the only thing that will put an end to this.
Then let's take it up to Ben. Let him decide.
We'll take it to Ben when I say it's time.
It's time, Robbie. It's time. They knew, and they let it happen. Two kids. Okay? It could have been you. It could have been me. It could have been any of us. We gotta nail these scumbags. We gotta show people that nobody can get away with this. Not a priest or a cardinal or a freaking pope.
Did that happen?
Well,
I would say the decibel level at which it happened in real life was somewhat lower. But Mike, one of the great things about Mike is his passion. And there are times, look, editors always win those arguments. And there are times when, you know, I'm more even keeled, less obviously passionate. But there are times when you have to say, wow, let's take this passion out on the street where it really works and let the editors make the decision. So it kind of, yeah, we had these, we had this tension, which is great. You know, when you have a team.
You're not going to let the editor still do all the talking.
You said it was an honor to be played by Mark Ruffalo, and it is. I think he's the greatest actor on the planet. He's also a pretty good reporter, as it turns out. It's somewhat to my chagrin, I would say, that he discovered and explored my, let's say, excitable side. And he did interview some of my colleagues as well as interviewing me, spending a lot of time with me. And I think he heard of a few incidents and probe deeper as a good reporter would, and the result is we have this scene.
Well, I'm speaking with Michael Resendiz and Walter Robinson. They are two of the really crusading journalists featured in the new film Spotlight, which opens on Friday. And of course, Spotlight is the story of the Boston Globe's investigation into the clergy sex abuse crisis. It's not that often that I get a chance to ask people what it's like seeing actors play them on the screen, but I gotta ask you both, what was it like having Michael Keaton and Mark Ruffalo play you? Did they get you? Did they get you right?
Yeah, you know, pretty much all of my friends who have seen the film have said in one way or another to me, oh my God, he got you. And they studied us. You know, in my case, Keaton watched videotapes of past appearances I had made on cable TV shows, on NPR shows. And he had, when I met him in New York for the first time about a year and a half ago, he already had my voice down. And then he spent the rest of that evening just sort of studying my mannerisms. And so on set, he even drops his voice an octave. Uh-huh. So because my voice is a little lower than his. But yeah, they got us. I mean, these are really great actors, and they don't often get a chance to play real people, so they basically, in effect, stole our identity.
It was pretty remarkable. Mark came to my home, and we walked around the neighborhood. We went to my favorite local restaurant. He spent several days shadowing me at the Globe. He essentially took part in an investigation that I was working on, listened to me interview people on the phone. And on the first night of shooting, after about the seventh take, I was watching it with our colleague, Sasha Pfeiffer, and suddenly she grabbed my arm and she said, oh, my God. And I said, what? And she said, he's got your laugh. And it's a strange little cough chuckle I do, almost like a nervous tick. And I didn't even know I did that.
Yeah. You know, we had the privilege of having Sasha be as a colleague here at WBUR for several years, and we all think that Rachel McAdams pretty much got her to spot on. So, I want to take a step back, guys, gentlemen, and we're having this conversation on Radio Boston to the Boston audience, and I really wanted to explore with you what you think this film means for people here. And there's a lot of ways to explore that. And then first and foremost is... do they overall get it? Does the film overall get it right? So that, you know, when people go to the theater and watch it, are they going to get a, even if it's Hollywood and dramatized, a pretty accurate representation of how this story came into being?
I think they will. I think the filmmakers did a remarkable job of capturing the substance of what we did, the spirit, and also of capturing Boston circa 2001. I mean, this is a movie that really accurately reflects the tribal nature of Boston in a way that no other movie has, perhaps since The Friends of Eddie Coyle.
Mm. Walter, what do you think about that?
Well, I think you could come away from this film with the sense that it's a eulogy to a practice, investigative journalism, that has kind of fallen by the wayside. But one thing to remember is that the Globe still has a spotlight team. It is 50% larger now than it was in 2001. It does more projects. The paper is more committed now, even than it was then, to doing this kind of reporting that holds institutions and powerful people accountable for their actions. And that's a really important point. And it's also important, I would say, newspapers around this country, many of them have cut back on investigative reporting because it's costly to do. But the fact of the matter is, every time a newspaper does a good readership survey and they ask their readers what really matters most to them, the answer is almost always investigative reporting. Mm.
The economics of the newspaper business are a whole other thing, though. But there's something that the film does that I actually thought was really interesting, because it doesn't shy away from challenges or revelations within the Globe itself. Because there's a scene in which it's sort of discussed that the Globe may have had access to some information about clergy sex abuse years before the Spotlight team launched its investigation. And in fact, Walter, you were Metro editor at the time, right? Years before?
Yeah, in 93.
Yeah.
Yes, I plead guilty. We actually ran a story in 1993 from a lawyer who represented plaintiffs saying that he had reported the names of 20 priests to the Archdiocese against whom allegations had been made. And we ran that story. Assume the readers saw it, the editors saw it, and when we started our investigation in 2001 and found that clip, none of us remembered it. Mm-hmm. And it was one of a few clues that, gee, maybe we should have been on this sooner. But a couple of points. Number one, if we'd reported it 3 or 4 years earlier in the pre-internet era, it wouldn't have had the currency, the wide currency that it had. And number two, every archdiocese in this country had two things in common. It had the same kind and the same level of abuse of children, and it had a daily newspaper. And no paper in this country got onto it, the scale and the depth of it. And finally, at least, we got it. We got it first.
You know, what I think is incredible about this movie and why it feels so authentic is because it is authentic. I mean, it's got my excitable side. It's got some mistakes we made. It shows us stumbling around in the dark. It shows how real reporters, who after all are real people, how they actually work and achieve what they achieve. I think it's the great strength of the movie that it shows our mistakes and our foibles.
It also shows that, you know, it's not easy work to try to get people to talk about these horrible violations that have happened to them. I mean, in reality, Mike, did that take any kind of toll on you?
Sure it did. I think it took a toll on all of us. I mean, we spent over a year meeting with victims and hearing often their very, very sad stories, hearing over and over how people's lives were destroyed by the experiences they had at the hands of people they should have been able to trust. I think at the end of the year, we really were sort of burdened by everything we had heard. We were also, I think, often angry by what we had heard. And I think it's really the victims and the stories that they told us that spurred us on to get to the truth and get to the bottom of things.
Mm. What do you think the movie leaves out that you wish had been in it?
Well, you know, I think there's very little that I could think of. I mean, Tom McCarthy, the director and co-writer, and Josh Singer spent not just days with us, but weeks and months with us, interviewing us repeatedly. And I think they emptied our pockets pretty thoroughly.
You know, the film ends with the very first story we published.
Right.
And then it notes in the first card afterwards that we published 600 stories in 2002. And there was an obviously enormous impact from those stories. So what isn't in the film is that shortly after the story broke, we brought on board to work with us four of the best reporters in the world, Steve Kirkshen, Tom Farragher, Kevin Cullen, and Michael Paulson. And they all share, you know, we did win the Pulitzer Prize for our reporting on this, and they share in it, and they are just remarkable reporters. Unfortunately, the film ends before they arrive on the scene.
Right. So my final question to you guys is, you know, It's a Hollywood production. It's not a documentary, and there has been lots of lavish critical appraise for Spotlight, which it wholeheartedly deserves. But I wonder if, as journalists, I mean, I'm speaking to two journalists here, is there any part of you that has hold a little bit of concern that for a lot of people who, you know, obviously outside of Boston, who didn't live this story, that the driving cultural impression now is going to come from a Hollywood product.
But, you know, here's a thought about the film. The film is not about us individually. The film is about how important investigative reporting is. And it's also, and this is part of the magic of Tom McCarthy, the director, through our eyes, as we report, you learn the story of the survivors of sexual abuse by priests and how their lives were ruined in many cases, how many of them committed suicide. The toll of this by such an iconic institution. And if you made a film simply about the survivors, people might not be able to stand that. But seeing it, their story through our eyes, I think is important. And it's important as a way to keep public attention focused on this issue.
Richard Sipe, who you see in the movie as an oracular voice who's studied this issue for 30 years, he saw one of the screenings with us, and he said he thought the genius of it is that it tells the stories of survivors and victims, but at one step removed. Mm. And it was the best way to tell that story because it's too horrific for people to get directly.
Well, later on this week and next week, we'll be talking with survivors. We'll be talking with lawyers connected to the case. We'll also be talking with the Boston Globe's Ty Burr about how Spotlight fits into the great canon of great newspaper films, as he called it. But for now, Walter Robinson, former editor of the Spotlight team and now editor-at-large at the Boston Globe. Such a pleasure always to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meg.
And Michael Resendiz, Boston Globe Spotlight reporter. Really always great to have you on the show. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
Spotlight opens on Friday, by the way. But stay with us for now, because there's more Radio Boston coming up in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.